Good morning. How's everyone doing this morning? Good. Good. Glad to hear it. Today I'm going to talk about joy. And after I chose this topic, I thought, boy, the pressure's on now. I'd better wake up in a good mood on that Sunday morning. I think I'm doing okay. So I think it's important to talk about joy. The first noble truth is the truth of suffering. And it's important that we acknowledge our suffering and deal with it. But sometimes the first noble truth gets translated as life is suffering. And sometimes that is understood as life is only suffering. And that is wrong. Life is not only suffering. Joy is not only part of the path, it's essential to the path. And that's the point I'd like to make today. I'd like to use an incident from the Buddha's life to explain joy. I'd like to start by giving just a little bit of background. 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha was born in northern India, in what is now part of Nepal, the Vedic faith was prominent at that time. There were Brahmins, priests at that time, who conducted rituals in a hope of affecting the natural order of things, of making things better for people by changing perhaps even the weather. And they would charge money for these services. And they possessed a kind of secret knowledge. You couldn't do these things yourself. You had to go and hire a priest to do these kinds of things for you. And there were some problems with this kind of institutionalized religion. And I think the area was ripe for a spirituality that had more meaning for the practitioners, that really came from inside rather than relying on someone outside. And it was at this time that the Buddha was born. And many of you are familiar with the story of the life of the Buddha, so I'm not going to go into a lot of details. You've probably heard about how there were certain predictions about how his life would be, and that his father tried to protect him. He grew up as a prince. His father was a king. But I'm not going to go into all that. I'd like to focus on an incident that happened when he was 9 years old, something that happened under a rose apple tree. It was an early spiritual experience that he had, that Siddhartha Gautama had. Tim talked about the rose apple tree last week, as many of you will recall. He talked about how this incident, this early spiritual experience of the Buddha, shows that we all have the capacity to become experts at being happy. He talked about things that conceal our natural joy and how we can cultivate our natural joy and remove those concealers. I'm going to try to cover some different ground today. I'm going to tell the story in a little more detail, and I'm going to look at the implications for our practice while focusing on the middle way. So what happened was, he was 9 years old and his parents took him to a plowing festival. This plowing festival was something that happened at the beginning of the growing season. We can imagine that it was an agricultural area and that the crops doing well was very, very important to people. So they would have this festival and they would bring the Brahmins in and they would do chants, and these chants would ensure that they would have a good harvest. And they made it a big community celebration. The sutras, the talks that the Buddha gave, don't really say anything about this festival. Basically, they just say that this experience happened to the Buddha one day as he was sitting under the rose apple tree, and they describe the experience, and they say this happened while his father was plowing. It's in the commentaries to the sutras that all of the details are added. And we don't really know whether the details are literally true, whether there really was this tradition of having a plowing festival, and so these kinds of things just fit in with what went on at that time. Maybe they're purely fanciful. We don't know, but it's a really good story. And there are many versions of this story. And there's a scholar named Edward J. Thomas who actually uses this as, he says, a striking example of a variety of legends based upon a single incident. So I've read many different versions of this story, and I've kind of put them together to make one good, coherent story. So it was a festival. And we can imagine there was feasting. We can imagine there were activities for the children, maybe some colorful banners around, all kinds of fun stuff going on. One version says that at the plowing festival there were 1,000 plows, 108 of which were silver, and one gold one for the king. You know, maybe, maybe not. But one part of the festival, a really important part, was the chanting by the Brahmins. And the 9-year-old Siddhartha was there, and the chanting was going on and on and on, and he was getting really bored, and he was really hot, and he was really sweating because it was a really hot day. And he asked his parents if he could leave and go somewhere where it was cool and just sit in the shade. And they said, okay. So he went and sat under this rose apple tree. And I didn't know what a rose apple tree was, but I thought it sounded really nice. I looked it up. It's a tropical tree of the myrtle family. It's about 25 feet high. It's not related to the apple, but it has crisp, juicy fruits that are rose-scented and are prized for jellies and confections. And it has a dense crown of slender, wide-spreading branches. So it would be a really good shade tree. Sounds very pleasant. So this part of the story comes mostly from Thich Nhat Hanh, from his book, Old Path and White Clouds. So he's sitting for a while under the tree, and he cools down, and he starts to feel a lot better. And after a while, he leaves the shade of the tree again, and he goes and he watches the plowing. And he sees a lot of things while he's watching the plowing, seemingly mundane things that might escape someone's notice normally. But he's cooled down and he's quite focused now. And he's struck by what he sees. He sees a water buffalo straining to pull a plow. And he sees the farmer behind the water buffalo sweating profusely, holding a whip in one hand and the reins in the other. And he's whipping the water buffalo. And he looks down at the furrow and he sees how the plow is cutting the dirt, and as it cuts the dirt, it's cutting little worms in half and it's destroying little insect homes. And he sees a bird swooping down and grabbing a worm and carrying it away and eating it. And he sees a larger bird catching a smaller bird and eating that. He sees all this stuff and he gets kind of stressed and he gets hot again. And he runs back to the rose apple tree, and he closes his eyes. He's oblivious to what's going on around him, and he's absorbed by the images of the field and the creatures. And he feels as if his own relatives have been killed. He's in pain from this. But he settles down. It's very cool. He continues to settle down. It's a beautiful day. And all of a sudden, this feeling comes upon him of great quiet and ease, and just time kind of stops, and everything is okay. And this feeling has been described by various writers in various ways. Thomas, whom I referred to before, called it joy and pleasure. The Sanskrit word for this that appears in the sutras is sukha, which means state of happiness. It's opposed to dukkha. Dukkha is what is normally translated as suffering. Sukha is the opposite of that. Sukha is a sense of ease. Thomas says that pleasure is probably too strong a word. What the Buddha would later say is that he entered into the first jnana, which is the first stage of meditation, a stage of heightened awareness. But I think we can think of this experience as joy and ease without attachment. And Karen Armstrong, who's written a biography of the Buddha called Buddha, which is a wonderful book, says that we have all experienced such moments which come upon us unexpectedly and without any striving on our part, a moment of ecstasy, a rapture that takes us outside the body and beyond the prism of our own egotism. and she calls it ecstasis, meaning to stand outside the self. She says it has nothing to do with the craving and greed that we normally see in our lives. So the child, Siddhartha, had been taken out of himself completely by this moment of spontaneous compassion that he felt for these little creatures that were being harmed. So I read that, what Karen Armstrong wrote, and I wondered, you know, have we all experienced such moments of great ease? You know, and I tried to remember back to my childhood for something like that. And I did think of an experience which I don't think I could describe it as a deep spiritual experience, but it's an experience of great kind of ease that just came to me that I've remembered my whole life. And I'll tell you about it. You may remember things from your own childhood, a similar experience. I grew up on a farm in North Dakota, southeastern North Dakota, which is a very, very flat area and very sparsely populated. And one of the crops we grew there was flax. Has anyone ever seen flax growing in a field? It's the straw of it is very wiry, and it's about this tall. And in the fall, it blossoms, and it's kind of a light blue, so that the field looks like a lake. It's really beautiful. And the flax straw is so dense that you can't leave it out in your field because it'll get into your plow and it'll gum things up, and you're always having to get off the tractor and pull it out of your plow. So you have to burn it. So we'd break it up into big loose piles and burn them. And we'd often burn them at night. And it was such a sight to see six big piles of flax straw burning in the night. You know, it was really fantastic. But we had one of these piles of flax straw up in our yard where our buildings were on the grass, loose flax straw. I don't know why we had it there. But I can remember going out one day and just sort of laying in this pile of flax straw, just laying back. And it was October. I was reading a book. And it, you know how in October the sky gets to be this special kind of blue that it isn't the rest of the year? Just this incredible, deep, beautiful blue. And I was looking at that, and I was under a pair of cottonwood trees. And I love cottonwood trees because they make this sound when the wind goes through. They just sort of rustle and rattle, and you can look up at them and you see all the leaves just dancing. It was a beautiful thing. And I can remember just putting my book aside and just laying there and just not wanting to go anywhere or do anything else, just being perfectly content in this pile of flax straw. And to this day, whenever I hear a cottonwood tree, when I hear that rustling, it makes me happy. And I'm really lucky because my meditation spot at home on an upstairs deck is close to a cottonwood tree, so I hear that all the time. But anyway, I think I was taken outside of myself a little bit in that experience. And I've talked to other people about this. I talked about this in my beginner's mind group, and one person in that group told me about how he had walked down to a pond when he was younger one time and just kind of sat there looking at the pond and just lost all sense of time. Just kind of did not know how long he was there. And that this was really the beginning of his spiritual life, he said. You know, that made him think, wow, there's something here that I have not even been aware of. So, a few Sundays ago, Eric Storley spoke here. And he also mentioned the rose apple tree. Seems to be the thing this year. And he talked about remembering childhood and being outside playing in the evening and just losing all sense of time, and suddenly you get called into the house and you realize that you've been completely out of yourself and lost yourself in play. I think that's a similar experience, and that's something we can certainly all relate to. So the Buddha had this experience, Siddhartha, I should say, he wasn't the Buddha yet, had this experience. And there are various enhancements to this story. One is that the shadow of the tree did not move all day. He sat there all day, and the shadow of the tree stayed in the same place to shade him. And his father came along and saw what had happened, bowed down to him. Another story from Thich Nhat Hanh is that he told Maha Pajapati when she came to collect him, reciting the scriptures does nothing to help the worms and the birds. So there's kind of a suggestion there that this was an early intimation of his concern with suffering and the need to transcend suffering and an understanding that we're not there yet. So. And then there are other parts of the story. He made an excursion from the palace when he was older. He encountered suffering for the first time. He became really obsessed with the problem of suffering and resolved to do something about it. He left his home. When he left his home to begin his spiritual quest, he found a teacher who had 200 or 300 followers. And this was one of the leading teachers at the time. And Siddhartha advanced very quickly through these yogic meditation techniques that the teacher taught. And the teacher said, "I have nothing more to teach you. Will you stay and help me lead this group?" And he said, "No, I have to keep moving. I think there's more to learn." He went to another leading teacher of the day who had even more followers. Same thing happened. He advanced quickly. The teacher said, "Will you stay and help teach?" And he said, "No, I have to keep moving." And he left them and began to engage in this path of austerities. And he found 5 companions. And so the 6 of them together practiced together, engaging in really rigorous ascetic practice. And there was a tradition of this in India. A lot of people did that. And there was actually sort of a progression of things you do. And, you know, you don't just make up your own program. There's kind of this pre-existing program for doing this. And there's kind of a belief that the body is bad and the mind is pure. And to sort of release the spirit, you know, we have to find this purity of mind, which means we have to conquer the body. That's the idea here. So they did terrible things to them. And the Buddha recounts this in the Mahasachaka Sutra. He says he tried to crush mind with mind. He tried various techniques of stopping his breathing. He stopped eating. He became really emaciated. And you may have seen pictures of the fasting Buddha or sculptures of the fasting Buddha where, you know, his middle section is only about, you know, this big around. He starved himself almost, and the color of his skin changed, and people would see him sleeping and they thought he was dead. It got to be really severe. And then something really extraordinary happened one day. One day, he was practicing. He was doing sitting meditation in a cemetery. And the sun had set. And this cool breeze came and caressed him. And he felt an ease he had not felt all day. Because his body felt better, his mind was eased. And he realized that his body and mind formed one reality that couldn't be separated. And that to abuse the body was to abuse the mind. And he said to himself, these are his own words, "By this racking practice of austerities, I have not attained any superhuman states and distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Could there be another path to enlightenment?" And it was then that he remembered the rose apple tree. And he remembered it's what Tim called last week an emotional memory. He recalled sitting in the cool shade, secluded from sensual pleasures, when he entered upon and abided in the first jnana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. And he asked himself, could that be the path to enlightenment? And he said, that is the path to enlightenment. And he thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome states? And he said to himself, I am not afraid. I am not afraid of that pleasure. And there is a sutra which distinguishes 2 kinds of pleasure, sensual pleasure and what it calls the bliss of renunciation, seclusion, peace, and enlightenment. But I think we should be a little careful about saying there are 2 kinds of pleasure, as if there is good pleasure and bad pleasure. I was talking to Tim about that, and he says even sensual pleasure is not something to be avoided. You can be out among the flowers in your yard and you can smell the flowers and be kind of intoxicated by it. And that's a sensual pleasure. And that is not a bad thing. That is a wonderful thing. It's attachment to sensual pleasure that causes you problems. You look for that pleasurable sensation again, and maybe you don't find it, and you're disappointed because it's not there. And you begin to imagine that if you could just have that pleasurable sensation again, that everything would be better. And pretty soon you're ascribing all kinds of characteristics to this sensation that it doesn't really have. It was just a moment of pleasure. It's not going to fix your problems. That's the attachment. So it's not so much that there's good joy and bad joy. Rather, there's joy, and there's the stuff we add to the joy. There's the attachment. There's all that emotional stuff that gets in the way and obscures the real experience. So, one thing I like about Thich Nhat Hanh is that more than some teachers, he talks about the joy of practice. He'll say, instead of follow your breathing, he'll say, enjoy your breathing. And of course we know that there are many, many ways that enjoyment can turn into attachment. So we have to be careful. But we can't deny joy simply because it can turn into attachment. We have to be skillful in cultivating joy. So back to the story of Siddhartha. He had this realization that joy is not something to be afraid of. And he thought about how hard it is to attain that while being so emaciated, so weak. And he took solid food for the first time in a long time. He ate some rice pudding. And his strength became restored. He spent, you know, he began to eat again on a regular basis. And with his strength restored, it wasn't long after that he decided that he was going to sit under a tree and he would not get up until he had solved this problem of life and death, this problem of suffering. We don't know exactly how long it is, but it seems that it was very soon after he gave up the austerities that he became enlightened. And he sat under the Bodhi tree and he became enlightened after 7 days, I think, he saw the morning star. And he became enlightened in that moment. And after his enlightenment, the stories tell us, first he just kind of enjoyed the enlightenment for a while. And then he thought about whether he should teach. And he hesitated a little bit about whether he should teach, about whether people would understand it. But he decided to teach. And he decided to teach first to his five companions. His two teachers had died, so he chose his five companions. We're not sure why he chose them. Perhaps because of loyalty to them, because they had done a lot for him. They had been through a lot together. Perhaps because he thought they had a similar experience to his and he would be able to understand that. We don't really know, but we know he sought them out. And they had, meanwhile, moved. They were 130 miles away. So he walked 130 miles to find these people. And, excuse me. They were a little upset with him. They accused him of engaging in luxurious living because he was taking solid food. And they wanted nothing to do with him. But when they saw him coming, they saw that his demeanor had changed and that he really seemed quite calm and serene. Plus, they were polite. They wanted to welcome him, so they gave him a place to sit and they decided they would listen to him. And he talked to them and he preached the first sutra, which is known now as the first turning of the wheel of the law. And in that sutra, he talked about the middle way and he talked about the Four Noble Truths. And I'd like to talk today about the middle way. What is the middle way? Karen Armstrong says, in connection with the middle way, the lesson of the rose apple tree is that nirvana is built into the structure of our humanity. Joy is our natural state. Thus, in this practice, we work with human nature, not against it. We amplify the positive things that are already in us. It's in there. We just have to find it. We just have to remove the things that obscure it. Daisaku Ikeda, who wrote The Living Buddha, says that the middle way rejects both asceticism and hedonism as extremes because they are both products of dualistic thinking. The ascetics viewed mind and body as two opposing substances, clearly to be distinguished from one another. The body is impure and evil, the spirit is pure and good. Only by destroying the one, or at least subjecting it to extreme mortification, can one set the spirit free. Hedonism, on the other hand, rejects purity of the spirit as a figment of the imagination. It believes in the existence of the body and the spirit as matter, and it tries as far as possible to satisfy all physical desires. So that's dualistic as well. So what does this idea of the middle way have to do with our practice? How can we draw on this as we are pursuing this practice? Well, for one thing, we don't go to extremes. It's not that simple. In all things, we have to navigate between extremes using wisdom. We can't plan our enlightenment as if it were a road trip. There's no map. It's not that simple. We can't pick one thing and say, we are going to do that to the max, and then we'll be enlightened. Not that simple. We can pick it, and it might work today, but tomorrow it won't. So I think that each of us has to find our own middle way. And I hope that none of us is in the position of deciding whether or not to starve ourselves. We're probably not in the position of deciding whether to completely abandon ourselves to riotous living. But there are implications for our practice, and I can think of three that I'd like to talk about. And the first is that we need to find the middle path with respect to the time and effort we give this practice. We can give this practice too little. We can definitely give too little time to this practice, and we've probably all experienced that. And what that is for different people varies. You know, some of us sit just a little bit every day. Some of us maybe sit once a week. Some of us maybe don't sit, and we come here on Sundays. And everyone has kind of their own place. For me, I really know I'm not sitting enough when it seems like my sitting lacks continuity. I sit down and I feel like I am starting all over again with this incredibly busy mind. And I kind of have no quiet and focus that I've established that I can draw on. When that happens, I think I need to spend a little more time on the cushion. On the other hand, you can give too much effort to this practice if you're neglecting your life, neglecting your responsibilities to your family or whatever, if you're using meditation as an escape rather than really dealing with what's going on in your life. I know I'm in trouble, for instance, if it's been several weeks since I've been to Menards, which means I'm not working on any house projects. I know I'm in trouble. So the appropriate amount of practice varies from person to person and by stage of life. You know, some people jump into this practice completely. You see them for the first time at the Zen Center one day, and 4 weeks later they're in everything and you see them everywhere. They just jump right in. I think that's really great. Other people stand back a little bit. You hear people say, you know, I've been walking by this building for 10 years. I've always been intrigued, and today I came in. You know, that's fine. We all have our own timetable. For me, my practice, I think, is just really slowly increased over the time I've been practicing formally, which is about 15 years. If you were to graph the amount of time I spend in meditation, it's just been a slow, steady increase over all of that time. So if you're able to just throw yourself into this practice and do it full time, I think that's wonderful. I hear Tim telling stories about San Francisco Zen Center in the early days, and it seems like everyone there was young, and it seems like they all just sort of quit their jobs and threw themselves into the practice and did these, were constantly on retreat, which may be an exaggeration, but I think, you know, that's a great opportunity if you can do that. On the other hand, if you have small children at home, your practice will be exceedingly irregular, and your meditation may occur only during nap time. And you may need a nap yourself during that time. So it may be quite limited. So we each need to find our own middle path with respect to the time we give this practice. We also have to find our own middle path with respect to our approach to Zazen. And that is kind of how tough we're going to be with ourselves during Zazen. And I've spoken many times about Pema Chodron's chapter in one of her books, The Wisdom of No Escape, I think it is, called Not Too Tight and Not Too Loose. And I mention that all the time because it was such a revelation for me to read that chapter. I knew all about being tough with myself on meditation, but I didn't know much about opening up in meditation. And I really learned from that chapter that you have to balance the two. On the one hand, we can be really militant with our practice. You know, a thought comes up and we feel we have to destroy the thought. We feel we have to crush our ego. We feel we have to conquer the pain in our body. And all of this creates problems. It's not only dualistic thinking, but it says, in that it says that thoughts are bad, but also it just can't work. I mean, think about the Buddha's statement of how he tried to crush mind with mind. How can you crush mind with mind? You can't. You only enhance the conflict in your mind when you try to do that. And Tigan Dan Leighton said a similar thing. He said, excessively austere reactions against the physical may only be further expressions of entrapment by them. And Karen Armstrong said, trying to blot out sensual desire only adds to it. Rather be aware of it, and it fades away. On the other hand, we can be too soft with our meditation. We can be so kind to our thoughts and kind to ourselves that we get to the point where meditation isn't really meditation at all. It's just daydreaming. We have to exercise some control. We have to have some discipline. My first teacher, whose name was Sukha, by the way, said, when you sit, you're like a mountain, and the thoughts are like clouds. Clouds just pass by. You don't fight them, you just let them pass by. She also liked to say, when you're sitting, invite your thoughts in. Just don't offer them tea. So we can find this middle path moment to moment. A thought arises, we acknowledge it, and we let it go. That's the middle path right there. The middle path occurs each moment. We don't go to the extreme of trying to kill the thought. We don't go to the other extreme of inviting the thought to lead to another thought. We need to give this practice our full attention and a soft kind of effort. We need to give that effort and open up and let go at the same time. It's not easy. Third, in finding our own middle way, we can look to the conditions that produced Siddhartha's feeling of ease under that tree and emulate them. The first was that I've identified three of these. One was compassion. It was because of his compassion for the little creatures that this happened. We can open ourselves to compassion and cultivate that. And that will lead to spontaneous ease. Second, the feeling of ease was produced by seclusion. You need to be in a quiet place to do this. You need to be alone. I mean, you may be in a zendo full of people, but you need to be alone facing the wall. And you have to meditate. I'm afraid the story of the rose apple tree doesn't mean that you can just kind of sit back and wait for enlightenment to come to you unbidden. It may, this feeling may come to you unbidden sometimes, and it shows you what's there. But to really access it at will, to really cultivate it, to really get to know it deep in your bones, and not just as a fleeting thing, you have to meditate. You need a regular practice. And retreats are very important. And I don't know if I need to say anything about retreats, because I think last I looked, we had, I think, 34 people signed up for Rohatsu. So people are doing retreats. And that starts, that's a week-long retreat for those of you who don't know. And there are 2, 5, and 7-day options. And I can't wait. 7 days of staring at the wall. I cannot wait. It's such an adventure, you know. And third, the Buddha's experience under the tree had its origin in this light feeling that came over him because he was enjoying the festival. He had, as Karen Armstrong says, he had a mood of calm happiness which modulated into the first jnana. And we can open to joy too. You know, we can remember the joy of our childhood. This is our natural state. It's in there. This joy is in there. It may be deeply buried in there. There may be times when it's so deeply buried that we're not sure we'll ever find it again. But this practice of meditation has a way of bringing us to places we never thought we could go. And I speak from experience. No matter how sad you might be, if you really pay attention, there are those moments when you're just there and nothing is added and you experience that joy of renunciation. Even in the midst of great difficulty, you can see that if you open your eyes enough. Now, sometimes we're here in the Zendo. We've been on a retreat or we've been here for a couple of sittings or something. And we've really made a great effort and we leave and we walk out and what do we see? We see the lake. And it's just there. And we have this moment where, wow, look at that, you know. And there's no us in that at all. There's just the lake. There's nothing else. And that's that moment of the joy of renunciation. And those moments are always there. They're always there. They're just so hard to see. But we need peace and quiet. And if you come here and you find that peace and quiet, you open yourself, you'll see them more and more. You can cultivate your ability to do that. And we can remember that there are these two incidents in the Buddha's life that took place under trees. There was that tree of enlightenment, the Bodhi tree, where he achieved enlightenment as a result of great, great effort, years and years of effort. And there's that earlier incident under the rose apple tree where this feeling of ease just came to him spontaneously with no effort at all. And we can remember those two. And this is the image of the middle way. These are the two things we need to balance. That ease and joy and opening and that discipline and hard work. And we can picture those images and remember that joy is our natural state. We can trust the child that's inside us. We can know that this practice is not about becoming someone else, but it's about getting in touch with who we already are. And we can say to ourselves, may I find the peace and tranquility that is my true nature. So, that's what I have to say about joy, and I wonder if anyone has any questions or any comments about anything I've said this morning.
I'm intrigued by the metaphor of finding the joy within us. Is it an action of looking and searching and sorting out, or is it something you patiently wait for?
I think it's more like stepping back. Stepping back and letting it happen. You know, letting everything that obscures it, letting that stuff go. If you can let all that stuff go and just be quiet and just be completely open, it'll come in. I don't think you can really look for it. Yes?
Fear is a concept that I kind of drift towards, because I think you said something about not being afraid to feel it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, I talk with a lot of people who they're not afraid of feeling it, they're afraid of losing the feeling. So that the awareness can feel joyful, but nothing lasts forever.
Yeah.
Some people say, I just assume stay where I'm at.
Oh, yeah.
Then get my hopes up.
Mm-hmm. I can understand that. That's kind of, I think that's where attachment comes in. You know, if the joy just comes up and you're not attached to it, there won't be any problem there. You know, joy comes up, it goes away again, everything is fine. So I guess the question is, how do you sort of avoid that attachment and learn to just see it and let it go again? And I think that's something we learn on the cushion. You know, letting go, and it takes it's such a hard thing to learn. It's so hard to let go of expectations. You know, I've been doing retreats for a long time, and I still have to remind myself before every retreat to not go with expectations that something's going to happen this time to sort of make me different and better and happier. You know, because if you're looking for something during retreat, you're not opening yourself up, and it just becomes this sort of exercise in futility. But it seems like if you get burned enough times, you start to get it. And you kind of know, okay, here it is. It's not going to last long. Well, that was fun. Okay. That was okay. You know, and you let it go. I think it's something that happens with when your practice deepens. Do you agree with that?
There's burned and then burnish.
Excellent. Thanks, Cindy. So, anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming this morning. It's been fun. Hope you all have a great day. Hope you stick around for some tea or coffee. And I think we must have some announcements. Yeah.